Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of F This Movie, the podcast that can really out-ugly those sons of bitches. My name is Patrick Bromley. I am joined tonight by the man who can out-ugly them all, JB.
Dick Laurent is dead.
We have survived a terrible summer. We have 1 month to go before October, our favorite month, scary movie month on F This Movie.
It's coming!
It is, so bear with us through a bunch of filler in September. Just kidding. These shows are going to be great. You can find our website at fthismovie.blogspot.com. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie, twitter.com/fthismovie, and you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com, or find us through DVD Verdict at dvdverdictpresents.com. Thanks to Michael Staley and Melissa Hansen and everybody at DVD Verdict for carrying our silly show.
I have a schoolgirl crush on Michael Staley. I suppose it will go unrequited.
Tonight we're talking about David Lynch's Lost Highway from 1997. But before we get into Lost Highway, I will start the show the way I start every show, with a silly little dance. JB, have you seen anything good lately?
Yes. I finally saw The Guard.
Okay.
With Brendan Gleeson and Don Cheadle.
Yes.
In fact, he's one of the executive producers. It's sort of In the Heat of the Night in reverse.
Okay.
Because the down-home sheriff, in this case, down-home is Ireland, turns out to be really, really on the ball, but sort of plays the fool so that he doesn't give anything away. A little bit like Columbo in a weird way. A little precious, a little indie, but definitely worth your time. It's really, really good.
The movie was marketed to make it look like Brendan Gleeson was only a fool. There's no indication that he's actually a good policeman. And to me, the marketing seemed to be sort of reminiscent of In Bruges, which is another really good movie that Brendan Gleeson is in. But I'm guessing the movies don't have a lot in common, aside from Brendan Gleeson.
No, not at all. Although it was interesting to see Mark Strong, because he's the bad guy in
every movie.
Well, yeah. He's the main bad guy in Kick-Ass.
Right.
Attempting an American accent.
Right.
And in The Guard, he's, I'm assuming, using his own voice.
Right.
Because he's British, and playing a very different character. But one of the things I like so much about The Guard is I get the feeling that the way the bad guys are portrayed is much more the way things are if your business is drugs and murder.
Okay.
That film tends to portray villains in a certain light. And this one portrayed villains in a very matter-of-fact way.
Mm-hmm.
Also having very full lives.
Right, okay.
Again, it was very, very much worth people's time to seek it out.
I would like to see it. The only new thing I've really seen is a movie called A Good Old-Fashioned Orgy with Jason Sudeikis and several other now sort of famous people. The movie was shot in 2007 and sat on the shelf for 4 years. Interestingly enough, just long enough for most of the cast to become sort of recognizable.
Yeah.
Tyler Labine is in it from Tucker and Dale vs. Evil and Lake Bell and Leslie Bibb and many recognizable people, even if you don't know their names. It is not great. It's a mess and it's dumb. It's very dirty. Not necessarily graphic sexually, just the language more than anything. We had talked on the summer show about R-rated comedies that don't seem to earn their R rating. I would argue that A Good Old-Fashioned Orgy really earns its R rating.
And could part of your reaction to the film, and I'm sorry to bring up your personal life, is that I believe you saw this film with your mother-in-law.
I did. My wife and my mother-in-law saw the movie.
Could that have skewed your...
Yeah, definitely. It was uncomfortable at moments, and I might have laughed more, but I guess I didn't want to seem like I was finding certain things funny. I don't know. I thought it was... I laughed a couple times. I liked the cast. You know, the movie it reminded me of was Zach and Miri Make a Porno, in terms of sort of its tone and everything. And I'm not the world's biggest Zach and Miri fan, so I thought this movie did some similar things a little bit better.
You never want to let on to your mother-in-law that you actually know what a dirty Sanchez is.
Right. Or even an orgy. Real quick, I thought maybe we could talk for just a few minutes, because last week, I believe, in your regular column, Shitting on the Classics, which everyone should read every Tuesday at fthismovie.blogspot.com. You brought up, or was this 2 weeks ago? Last week was Beatles. Two weeks ago was George Lucas.
Yes.
And you brought up the changes that were made.
I'm so proud of myself, because if you don't go to the Digital Bits, Bill Hunt does an amazing job. That is a wonderful website that can keep you informed about all sorts of stuff. But I was so happy because I brought it up at the last minute that I didn't intend that to be part of the column. And then it just exploded on the interwebs.
Right.
That everyone is suddenly shocked that he's going to mess about with these films again.
In case you haven't heard, and I'm sure you have, there are new changes to the original Star Wars trilogy, which is coming out on Blu-ray, I think, next week. Darth Vader screams no again before throwing the Emperor down the shaft or whatever. Spoilers for Return of the Jedi.
Because in the original version, no one understood that Darth Vader didn't like what the Emperor was doing to his son. No one understood that.
Well, because he was quiet, and so I always just thought it was a goof. So now the Ewoks blink, and Ben Kenobi makes a different sound in the original Star Wars. Do you have any thoughts on any of this?
I think I talked about this in the column, but then a couple days later, Bill Hunt was invited to go to ILM or someplace and view some of the footage. And he's sort of the one who first said this. And obviously he was deluged with email and comments and things. And a couple days later, he wrote something that I thought was really true. He said he no longer regards those films as the original Star Wars trilogy, that they've been played with and tweaked and added to and rethought and in some cases reshot and rescored and that so much of them has been changed, he no longer regards them as the films that he held close to his heart when he was a child. And I think there's something to that. There's a very angry review of the new Blu-ray set on Amazon, if you want to seek it out, where basically someone who knows a lot about the changes that have been wrought to A New Hope suggests that the film was nominated for 10 Academy Awards. It won 7, but that everything that the original film won those Academy Awards for has now been changed. And so this is very serious, and I recognize his right as an artist to do it, but I also think it's cultural desecration because there was something to that original film that means something and has value, much more value than the bonus feature on one of the re-releases where the way they got you to buy that one is that, oh, there's a disc we threw in there with the original film before we messed
right,
with it.
Right.
It's not something I'm going to lose sleep over. I'm a little upset that you have to buy all 6 films to get all of the extras, which is the thing I'm most interested in watching. I feel like I'm being tricked into buying something I don't want to get something that I want. But again, on Amazon, someone did a full review of the extras, and there really isn't as much on there as you would think. And someone went on to say that, well, this is their way of getting you to buy it the next time.
Right.
Because they're never going to give you everything. And then the reviewer, and I wish I remember his name, compared it to the Alien set and other really archival Blu-ray releases that really attempt to give you everything and aren't looking 2 years down the road for you to open your wallet again.
Right. It just seems like a side with no, or an argument with no winners, obviously, because Lucas, I think, is in the wrong. But at the same time, I think the fan reaction is so wildly over the top that somehow now this is the line in the sand. I was fine with 100 other changes, but now you've made 3 more. I refuse to buy this. We've come to terms with Greedo shooting first and extra Jabba the Hutt and the loss of that song at the end of Jedi. All these other changes that we've been dealing with since the 90s. And now all of a sudden Darth Vader says no. And that's the deal breaker?
And it actually makes me think, and this is giving them credit for being incredibly cynical, that the reason they did it is because they're banking on the uproar being a marketing tool. And that would be horrible.
Yeah.
My son had a theory that Lucas was so personally hurt by many people's reactions to elements of the new trilogy, the prequels that he made, that if at the end of Revenge of the Sith, Anakin yelling no gets this laugh, mm-hmm. and it sometimes does, mostly because of the way it's shot, because it's a cliche.
Right.
That now he's going to shove it down our throat. He's going to make us pay for laughing at him in Sith by inserting it into a film that we actually have love for. But then I also heard another theory that Lucas has this sort of autistic desire
mm-hmm.
for circularity.
Right.
Was it you who bounced this off?
It was mine, but it was not. That theory did not originate with me. I want to say it was Devin Faraci,
which is what you told me on Sunday, that yeah. he wants everything to come full circle.
Right.
And, oh, isn't it ironic that three films later he says the same line in this? Right. Well, no.
Right.
Not. Do you know what irony is?
Even at the expense of your film, you know, it's one of the worst moments in Revenge of the Sith and is sort of publicly laughed at all the time, but just so that things are symmetrical, I'm going to put it back in. I don't know. I tend to not think he would do it out of spite, but at the same time, I think about when they finally did put the non-tampered Star Wars films out on like the second pressing of the DVDs,
yes.
and they were not anamorphic, and they had like the wrong sound mix, and it was the worst possible. It yeah. was like, here you go, pretty worthless. And that to me was definitely out of spite. So. I don't know.
I'm waiting for a day, I'm guessing 2015, where these are re-released again, and at the end of Jedi, when the Emperor is trying to kill Luke,
mm-hmm.
and Darth Vader, finally realizing that's my son, I have to do something about this, picks up the Emperor, and suddenly Jar Jar Binks
I like it.
Enters the scene.
I like it.
For no reason whatsoever.
Right.
And says something like, "What's the use of doing, sir, with the Emperor, sir?" And then maybe he's killed by a stray bullet or something, or collateral damage. Or
no, Jar Jar can't die.
Luke throws his lightsaber. But I'm waiting for the day where Lucas gives us more Jar Jar,
yeah.
because we all know what people think of Jar Jar.
Is it hypocritical, too, because, like you had said, it's cultural desecration. But look at a movie like Blade Runner. We're now on, I think, our fifth version of Blade Runner, and people aren't really complaining about that. In fact, people sort of welcome it.
Well, one of the reasons is because every time they play with Blade Runner, it gets better.
Exactly. Is that all it is? I mean, is
but
it just...
My jury is still out about the narration, because the first version that came out
yeah.
had the narration.
Yeah.
So, okay, you're looking very skeptical, but hear me out. And I may be wrong. Everyone originally saw it with the narration. So, when the version is finally released without the narration, you can't deny that your viewing of the film without narration is informed by your previous viewing with the narration. I'm not making a case for the narration.
Right.
I'm saying if the film had remained with the narration, I don't think it would have been the worst thing on earth.
Sure.
I'm not a fan of the narration. I just think it's a very knee-jerk response to go, oh, well, the narration wasn't necessary.
Right.
Because you originally had it the first time you watched the film.
Right.
I agree it's a better film without it.
Right. And it was a studio imposition. But now we're, again, back to this question of, here's Ridley Scott's original intent, which is a movie without narration. Well, was Lucas's original intent... I mean, it's not like he didn't have the money to have Darth Vader say no back in 83, but, you know, he argues this is the way... This is the way the movies would have looked if I had had the money and the resources at the time.
And I think Blade Runner does us a tremendous service by giving us all five versions.
Exactly. And so, I think that's a difference, too.
So we can watch them. And
right.
I'm comparing this to Touch of Evil, which Universal stole away from Orson Welles and re-edited it. And in a very famous 58-page memo, he outlined why their changes were wrong and how he would put it back. And obviously the film went out the way Universal wanted it, and then decades later, a team put the film back the way he wanted it. And again, like Blade Runner, it's better.
Right.
It's a better film
right.
the way Welles intended it. I don't think anyone Oh, maybe I'm wrong. If you disagree, send us an email or post something on Facebook. I don't think anyone is going to argue that the tweaked original trilogy are better. I don't think anyone's going to argue that they're better. Yeah. Maybe it just comes down to that.
Maybe. I who knows if there's a new generation of kids coming up who would not have tolerance for the original special effects and don't mind the CGI. You and I see that because we grew up with it the way it originally was, and the CGI is jarring, and it doesn't seem right in the movie that we grew up with. But
and there's a charm to the original special effects.
Yeah.
And again,
but the generations younger than us are not charmed by handmade special effects.
True, but I think at some point the film is done, mm-hmm. and I often wonder if Lucas had spent that money and that time and all those resources on another film.
Right. He's in a. We did a podcast on Phantom Menace, and we came up with this notion that George Lucas is trapped in a Star Wars cage, and he can't do anything but tinker with Star Wars, and that's what's going on.
I remember that. I actually listened to the podcast that I'm not on.
Thank you very much for doing that.
I do.
As long as we're talking about a director's intent versus the cumulative effect, the execution, whatever you want to say, let's move into David Lynch and Lost Highway.
Ooh, Lynchland.
We're going to be spoiling Lost Highway because I don't think there's any way to talk about the movie and any of its meaning without sort of giving away what happens or what we might think it's about. So if you haven't seen Lost Highway and you plan to, I think you should. Go find it. It's available on DVD. Come back and listen to the podcast. If you have seen it, keep listening. It's going to get weird.
It might. I start coming to the opinion that all of Lynch's films are actually one long film that take place in Lynchtown.
Right.
And he's just showing us different aspects of it. On this side of town, there's a homecoming queen who has been murdered, and that's Twin Peaks. And then you move a couple blocks south, and there's the neighborhood with blue velvet. And over here, on the bad side of town, is Lost Highway. Because until I rewatched Lost Highway for this podcast, I had a devil of a time, and I just saw it last summer. Last summer, the AV Club from The Onion showed Lost Highway at the Music Box, the happiest place on earth, and it was the first time I had seen it in a movie theater since it first came out. That sometimes I have a devil of a time disaggregating Lost Highway from Mulholland Drive. They're very much of a piece.
And they're very similar, and I think a lot of people would argue that Mulholland Drive is Lost Highway done better. And I actually wasn't really able to start understanding Lost Highway until I saw Mulholland Drive, and I sort of figured out what was happening in that movie, and then I thought, oh, that's sort of what's going on in Lost Highway also.
Yeah. Both films, I think what Patrick's referring to is, both films sort of break into two pieces.
Right.
That Mulholland Drive is maybe an hour, hour 15, hour 20, and there's one reality, and then something turns, and we're in a very different reality. In Lost Highway, of course, we're following Bill Pullman around on this strange journey. And, man, I can still remember the first time I saw this movie.
Me too.
I've seen a lot of movies, my friends, but I never seen that happen. Major spoiler alert. Bill Pullman turns into another character.
Right.
Played by another actor.
Right.
He happens to be in prison. They have to let him out. Because it's not him. And Balthazar Getty, who he's transformed into, gets to go home to Gary Busey, his father. And then we follow him for a while. And lo and behold, at the end of the film, he turns back into Bill Pullman.
Mm-hmm.
You got to give Lynch credit for that. That is a leap in narrative brio.
When I saw Lost Highway in 97, first of all, I think that movie more than most that I can think of benefited from being seen in a movie theater.
Yeah.
It does not translate as well, I don't think, to VHS or DVD or home video at all.
For two reasons I can think of just off the top of my head. The film plays a lot with darkness.
Yes.
And that doesn't translate very well to TV screens. And also the music,
right.
Unless I'm mistaken, didn't Trent Reznor have something to do?
He did a song. I don't think he did much of the score, obviously, that was Angelo Badalamenti.
That, as in most Lynch films, there are things going on with the music and the sound effects that are better served in a movie.
Yeah, it was just such an experience, and I wasn't prepared for it at all. And again, if you're not a David Lynch fan, chances are you're not going to like Lost Highway, and I know he's sort of an acquired taste. Not everybody likes him. I tend to like his movies a lot. Lost Highway, actually, I think is maybe his most underrated movie and possibly my favorite of his. And when I saw it in 97, it was such this experience that I wasn't ready for. It's one of only two movies in my life that kept me awake all the night. I saw that movie during the daytime. I went home. I was up the entire night trying to piece together what I had just seen. It really unsettled me in the ways that it wanted to, but also I was really trying to understand the through line of that movie.
And no one is better than Lynch at upsetting people in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
Because when Patrick was just talking about his experience with Lost Highway, it reminded me that when I first got married, Twin Peaks premiered on American TV, and I can still remember it was on Thursday nights, and the second episode after the pilot had something so disturbing in it at the end.
Is that Sometimes My Arms Bend Back?
Oh, you bet.
Yeah.
The Man from Another Place, and he's talking backwards, but he's not. You can understand it. And it kept me up all night.
Yeah.
It was the most disturbing thing I'd ever seen on American TV. But again, I think there's a talent for that. And what I compare it to is when MTV was new, this was a long time ago, folks, and they actually showed music videos. I used to break down the music videos in two categories. The pretenders, not the band,
right,
but the filmmakers who were pretending that they would try to make it so weird, and it just didn't come off because it just came off as affected and studied. And then the musicians or the filmmakers who made videos that were honestly twisted and
yeah.
Oh my God. The one I always pointed to was Peter Gabriel's Shock the Monkey video, which, say what you want, is really strange.
Mm-hmm.
Lynch is really strange.
Yeah.
And I think one of the reasons for that is that he started as an art student. And I think to a great extent, we're supposed to regard his films as abstract art, not try to figure them out, at least in terms of a narrative. Although I find his narratives interesting.
Yeah.
That it's a cliche, but I want to say it's the journey. You're not going to puzzle this film out.
Right.
It's going to resist that.
Right.
But that's one of its charms.
Right. And you could certainly do pieces like Lost Highway. There are definitely large pieces that I can say, okay, this is kind of what's happening. But at no point will you have all of your questions answered, because...
And I think that's what he excels at, because
right,
there are sequences that are perfectly understandable. It's when you try to put it together. And I remember, I wish I knew the issue number, there's a wonderful magazine called Video Watchdog that once did a column comparing the original cut of Blue Velvet to the cut that was released. And what Tim Lucas found was that Lynch's original film was much more specific about a whole bunch of things, and that what he did between the rough draft, for lack of a better word, and the release print is he took out things that left things more abstract,
mm-hmm,
that left things more puzzling. Frank Booth, played by Dennis Hopper, takes Kyle MacLachlan for a ride. And we're not quite sure what happens, but we're pretty sure we know what happened. In the original cut, that was made very explicit.
Right.
Which reminds me, I watched the film today in anticipation of the podcast, and the DVD, I think it was at the beginning, had the rating up on the screen.
Okay.
And it's repeated on the back of the box, too. But I had never seen this one, because, you know, they're getting much more specific
right
about what the little box says. Lost Highway is rated R for bizarre, violent, and sexual content. Exactly.
Who makes that call?
I've seen rated R for violent and sexual content.
Right.
Can you imagine whoever it is at the MPAA? Well, we really need to tell people that this is bizarre. And what about the person who watches this film and says, that's not bizarre at all?
Well, right. I mean, the film, I guess you could say, has elements that are bizarre, but I don't know if the specific violent and or sexual content is bizarre.
It's very strange. I've always thought that Lynch made this film called Eraserhead. I'm a huge fan of Eraserhead. I used to force my students to sit through it, and it was a tall drink of water for them. I really love Eraserhead. But I always thought Lynch's commercial breakthrough was when he realized you can do all of those abstract things, you can do all those surreal things, if it takes the form of a mystery. Because then it's not obscure bizarreness.
Right.
It's a clue.
Right.
It's a clue that you want to pay attention to. And I thought Twin Peaks brought us there, because now suddenly we're trying to figure out this murder. And to a lesser extent, Blue Velvet does the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to figure out what's going on in mm-hmm. the town. So at the beginning of Lost Highway, someone's at Bill Pullman's front door, and he hits the little intercom button, and he hears a voice say, "Dick Laurent is dead." And if you love movies at all, that opens an entire world. Who is Dick Laurent? Why is it important that he's dead? But on the surface, the moment is very, very surreal. A stranger comes to your door
right.
and says something inscrutable. So I think the same thing is going on there. Also, in terms of individual sequences working, I can still remember the first time I saw this movie. Patrick said, you know, it kept him up at night. Someone puts a videotape on your front steps, and when you eventually put it in your VCR, and that's a little dated, it's a videotape of someone walking through your house at night, and it ends in your bedroom with you sleeping. That is a very disturbing thought.
Yeah.
And that's how this movie begins.
And that's you know, again, that's the stuff that takes place in the quote-unquote reality section of the movie. Because
that's before things get weird.
Exactly. I mean, that's – and it's just one of those things that you know, you can't – you're never going to solve that, even as you say, okay, I understand the transformation of Baltazar Getty, and I get all what's happening there. The videotape thing is never resolved. It's just – weirdness to sort of pull you into the movie. And I don't think it's weirdness for its own sake, because like you said, it's very effective. And it also obviously adds to the sense of paranoia that Bill Pullman's character is beginning to experience, because he's convinced that his wife, Patricia Arquette, is cheating on him.
And at that point, we have to ask, which Patricia Arquette? Because apparently there's two of them, or are there?
Yeah.
One clue we do get to the videotape, though, at the very end,
yeah.
in the house that can't decide if it's on fire or not, we see the Robert Blake character with a very old-fashioned, cumbersome camcorder. So that might be his way of tying it up. Another thing I was thinking as I watched the film, and I think we brought this up during Independence Day, I'm watching the film, and Bill Pullman is so good
mm-hmm.
in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's underrated because he's been in so much crap.
Yeah, and he's been bad in stuff.
But I'm thinking of Accidental Tourist,
mm-hmm.
Independence Day, Zero Effect, this. I actually liked him in The Serpent and the Rainbow.
Mm-hmm.
When he has good material, he's really good. And I would argue the part he plays in Lost Highway is very difficult to pull off.
Do you think that, and we had mentioned this on the Independence Day podcast, that part of what he brings to that role is sort of this sense of squareness. Do you think in any way that his performance in Lost Highway benefits from that?
Yes.
That he's sort of playing against his own squareness, which is sort of a Lynch archetype.
Well, he's supposed to be hip because he has a hip pad and he's a musician.
Right.
But I would say he's still playing on the squareness, because for some of the film, he's the audience surrogate, and clearly there are things going on around him
right.
that he does not have knowledge of. So
right.
he's the square who's in the dark and right. uninformed.
Right. But then by the time you make it to the end of the movie, you realize, you know, it's that question of the unreliable narrator or
right.
whatever. Because by the end of the movie, you realize that even though you've experienced the movie through him, you were not given all the information.
Not at all. And that... the way I interpret it, and at this point, when you get to the end of this movie, all bets are off.
Right.
That he's a different person at the end than he was at the beginning. That we have seen his character change.
Okay. Really?
Yeah.
In what way?
That was
my first reading of the movie. I'll tell you my first reading of the movie, but...
That he's more clued in, that he's more in control.
Okay.
He's clearly very much the victim at the beginning.
Right.
Not only of this videotape and his wife, who it seems to me is obviously cheating on him.
Right.
But at the end, I just see him as much more in control. All the nonsense around the house and even the fact that he's driving away at the end.
Okay.
And he's being pursued.
But isn't the driving away at the end just sort of his last-ditch effort to escape his own death? Because the way I've always read that last shot, when he's actually finally transforming into this monster that we realize that he is, this guy who murdered his wife, and he starts to smoke and it's flashing, that's him in the electric chair, no? That's the way I always read that. And so that driving at the end is him still trying to escape what's coming.
His fate.
Yeah. And if he is in control at the end, it's only because I think he's finally sort of come to terms with what he has done.
Well, he's finally doing something, but I've never interpreted the end of the film that way.
Okay.
I've always interpreted it as 45 minutes in, we see him turn into Balthazar Getty.
Yeah.
And then at the end, I feel he's turning into something else.
Okay.
Because it is very similar in that his head shakes. And
right. And, you know, the whole, again, there's no right reading of the movie. And some people will be frustrated by this. A lot of times I don't like a movie where I just feel like this could be anything. This could be about anything. And I don't know. And I'm not meant to know. You know, I had some of that with Tree of Life. While the narrative is fairly linear, some of it became nonsense to me and it didn't connect with me at all. And I'm sure there are people that feel that way about Lynch, but for whatever reason, I just like the effect his movies have on me, even when I don't totally understand. But the Balthazar Getty is just his escape fantasy that in order to separate his mind from what he has done, because again, this is assuming that he really did murder his wife. He gets thrown in jail. He can't obviously handle what he has done, and so his conscience kind of splits off and creates this fantasy where he's another guy, he's a cool guy who gets all the ladies.
Yeah.
He's not this patsy whose wife is cheating on him. But throughout the Balthazar Getty fantasy, there's these little breaks where his real life is coming through. The jazz music on the radio,
yes.
The picture at the end, which, is this you? Are they both you? He's realizing, you know, that the real world is breaking in to his fantasy. And by the end, that's happened completely, which is why he switches back to Bill Pullman. And so, to me, he's still the same guy, just a guy who sort of can't escape his own actions anymore. They finally caught up with him, if that makes sense.
I like your interpretation a lot. And again, Lynch is mum on this. Lynch knows how to play the game.
Well, the only reason I came to this, A, is like I said, Mulholland Drive, which sort of tells this same narrative.
Yes.
A woman who does something can't deal with creates a fantasy to escape. But Lynch did say that one of the inspirations, I think, for Lost Highway was the O.J. Simpson case.
And that's interesting because although I've always been a fan of Eraserhead, I liked it a lot more when I read an interview where he sort of peeled back the curtain a little bit to the extent that he would and suggested that a lot of his anxieties about his upcoming baby, informed the film, and that if you look at it that way, it's a bizarre, surrealistic nightmare of everything that can go wrong when you meet a woman and decide to have a child. Her family is beyond awful, and there's something wrong with the baby. Then your wife will desert you, and you will be forced to care for this baby. That really made the film come into focus for me.
Mm-hmm.
But like you're discussing with Lost Highway, I think there's moments in Eraserhead where we sort of go off on imaginative tangents. There's a woman in the radiator who sings to him that's clearly a fantasy of unfettered sexuality, that what I could have if I wasn't tied down in the most depressing room ever with piles of dirt and plates full of water in the drawers. I know I like your interpretation of Lost Highway a lot. It's so much better than mine.
Well, I think what you're describing is that that night that I stayed up was sort of, that was because I was sort of reading the movie in a more linear way. And it was like, in order to get him from point A to be this new version of Bill Pullman, he has to go on this crazy journey that it's almost supernatural. And Robert Blake is somehow involved in transforming him into this monster at the end of the movie. That was my, again, my, that's how I read it originally, but.
And that's another reason why I like Lynch, because in all of his films, there's creepy stuff, and I would argue that the creepy stuff always works.
It does, and like you said, it never feels like, there's lots of directors who try and do creepy or disturbing, especially now, sort of the proliferation of, like, the Saw movies or whatever, where disturbing is sort of in vogue, but David Lynch does it in a way that it could just be Robert Blake talking to you at a party with no eyebrows, but he says something, or sometimes my arms bend back. It's such a simple line, but it's so
and again, scary. It's very cleverly worked out because you see an unusual looking man at a party. You ask if you had ever met before, and the man replies that he's not there. He's at your house, and he hands you his cell phone. You dial your house, and he picks up the phone.
Right.
Again, on the card I wrote, ah!
And the way that sequence is handled is so great, because all the music drops out. I mean, there's so many great little set pieces.
And it also contains a great joke.
Okay.
I think it was intended as a joke.
Okay.
Bill Pullman is talking to Robert Blake. Robert Blake insists he's not there. He's at Bill Pullman's house, hands him the cell phone. Bill Pullman calls his own house on the cell phone, starts talking to Robert Blake. And at the end of their conversation, the Robert Blake on the phone says, "Give me back my phone." That's terrific. Patrick was commenting earlier that the film can sometimes seem willfully obscure, but I couldn't help think when I was watching it again today in that a lot of people might think the pace of this film is very slow. And I began to compare it to the film that I talked about today, on shitting on the classics, La Ventura, because they're actually almost the exact same length. And they both have a very deliberate pace, and they're both willfully obscure. But I think there's a real difference here, because I think when you go along with Lynch for the ride, you're rewarded in a lot of ways that you're not rewarded with the emptiness and longing of La Ventura.
The movie, to me, I watched it for the podcast, and I've seen it a bunch of times, so I just sort of had it on, and I was doing other things, but I wanted to refresh myself. And it did seem slower to me than it had in the past, and I felt like that's because I wasn't paying as close of attention, that, again, when I saw it in the theater or when I've watched it since, if you allow yourself just to sit in the dark and watch this movie, that it casts a spell.
Yes.
And I wasn't allowing that to happen today because I was doing other things, and so the movie seemed slower than usual, if that makes sense.
And it used to be very interesting to watch Lynch movies in a theater, because I very well remember when I saw Blue Velvet, and Blue Velvet did not come out to the suburbs. You had to drive downtown to the late lamented Fine Arts Theater, and the audience there was so tragically hip. They were really tuned to the irony of the film. So anything that was even halfway meant that it sort of went overboard in a sort of Douglas Sirk way. The opening shot of the fireman on the fire engine in slow motion waving gets a tremendous laugh because we know that he's... But as Lynch continues to make films, that hip, ironic laughter disappears.
Yeah.
Because the films start getting darker.
Yeah.
And more perplexing, and I think some of the hipsters drop out of his audience. Certainly Blue Velvet is his most accessible film.
Yeah, definitely. But it also has a lot of that sort of hipster irony, as does Wild at Heart, I would say. But Lost Highway has almost none of it. Until you get to some of, I think, the Robert Loggia stuff. And that's the stuff that feels more like out of Twin Peaks or Blue Velvet, I think.
And at this point, we should discuss Robert Loggia, because... He's an actor that I'm fond of. I think he's never really been given a chance to really show his chops, or maybe he's just a limited actor. He, too, is an Independence Day.
That's right.
He's played a lot of gangsters. Yeah. He had a memorable little story arc on The Sopranos one season.
He got to play a gangster vampire in Innocent Blood.
And I just have a tremendous affection for him. But here's what I heard, and I don't know if this is true, but I hope it's true because it's a great story. Apparently, Loggia auditioned to play Frank Booth in Blue Velvet, and Dennis Hopper got it, and it became a career-capping performance for Dennis Hopper. And apparently, Robert Loggia was either angry that he didn't get the part, or he felt he was mistreated, or he was led along, or that they didn't inform him the right way. So the story goes, and this might be apocryphal, that Robert Loggia is very, very upset. A couple years go by, and Loggia and David Lynch meet up somewhere. And apparently, Loggia let him have it. Just yelling and screaming about how you don't treat me that way and everything like that. And apparently, Lynch listened very carefully and then wrote the part of Dick Laurent for Robert Loggia. And I think you see that in what has become one of the iconic scenes. We're going to try this for the first time, folks. At one point, Robert Loggia, who's something of a gangster, is driving in his car, and someone's tailgating him. And he eventually lets this person pass, and then he becomes very upset because he's been tailgated, and he drives very fast and catches up with the guy, and this is what happens.
Tailgate. Hammer! I won't
ever. Do you know how many fucking car lengths it takes to stop a car at 35 miles an hour? 6 seconds, Charlie! That's 106 fucking feet, mister! If I had to stop trembling, you would have hit me! I want you to get a fucking driver's manual! I want you to study that motherfucker! And I want you to obey the goddamn rules! 50,000 people were killed on the highway last year because of fucking assholes! Like you! Tell me you're gonna get a manual!
Get a manual?
Fucking A!
I'm sorry about that, Pete. But tailgating is one thing I cannot tolerate.
An unbelievable scene, and as I was telling Patrick before we started the podcast, I guess you'd have to do this as a red band or something, but I always thought they should take that scene and turn it into a public service announcement for safe driving.
Yeah. Then that is, I think, the only example really in Lost Highway of that element of David Lynch movies that we were kind of talking about, the sort of ironic comedy that it's supposed to be kind of funny, the disconnect between the violence and the rage and the fact that he's saying, don't tailgate.
Do you know how many car lengths
it takes to stop? And David Lynch does a lot of that stuff, but not much in Lost Highway. Lost Highway is largely a humorless movie.
No, in fact, you can see the progression of David Lynch's art as a film that I believe is completely humorless, which is Eraserhead.
Yeah.
And then he gets popular acceptance with Twin Peaks, which is very quirky and funny, mm-hmm. and then Blue Velvet. And then, almost like realizing where it's headed, he starts getting more and more serious and willfully obscure and far less of the ironic comedy.
What are your feelings about Patricia Arquette as the sort of femme fatale in the movie?
I don't think she works.
Okay.
At all.
Okay.
Either playing the original character, which is Bill Pullman's wife, or later on
Renee is the brunette, and Alice is the blonde.
And I've never really been a fan of Patricia Arquette. I think what this role demands might be beyond her, unless she was directed mm-hmm. to give the performance that she does. I don't know. I've never been a fan of her in this film.
I ask because I can't quite make up my mind. I'm not the world's biggest Patricia Arquette fan, with the exception of True Romance, where I think everything she does is great in that movie. And it's one of those that it's like, is it good casting or is she truly capable of giving a great performance? She just has to be in the right role. I don't know. Lost Highway, I'm back and forth because sometimes I feel like, well, she's just sort of a blank slate, an empty vessel. And then other times I think, well, that's the point, that she's so impenetrable, especially as Renee, where maybe she is cold and aloof because she's cheating on him, or maybe she's just, we're misreading all of that.
That she's a blank slate.
Exactly. Maybe we're just misreading that because, again, we're seeing the movie through him. And same with her role as Alice, that she's sort of more playing this archetype instead of an actual human being.
And it might be that David Lynch wants that to be ambiguous, but I'm sort of puzzled by the ambiguity.
I don't know. I feel like another actress might have played, would have been more obvious. Maybe that's the wrong word. I feel like
Patricia, that it would have been much more specific.
Right. Or just like, I'm playing the femme fatale. I can't think of a good example. I think of like, did you ever see Blue Dahlia or Black Dahlia?
Yeah.
Brian De Palma.
Mm-hmm.
Hilary Swank is doing this weird version of what she thinks a femme fatale is from watching other movies. And it's very sort of by the numbers and it doesn't work. And I think Patricia Arquette sort of goes another way.
I think what we're left with in Lost Highway is she's either playing a cipher,
mm-hmm,
or it's not a very good performance.
Right.
I'm having a hard time deciding.
And I guess so am I.
What it is we're looking at. But Patricia Arquette's performance does raise something that I did want to bring up. A couple podcasts ago, I mentioned the work of Nicholas Roeg, a filmmaker who didn't make that many films, but he made some very interesting films. And I pointed out that Roeg had a particular interest in seeing his actors naked. And watching Lost Highway again, I have to say, I think Lynch trumps Roeg. Is there any leading lady who does not disrobe?
No.
It's kind of weird and crazy.
Well, yes and no. I mean, because all of his movies are so sort of focused on sex and sexuality.
Yes.
It almost becomes sort of necessary. And I guess the same could be said of Nicholas Roeg. It's not just like people are getting naked in a comedy about whatever. I can't think of it.
Someone putting together an orgy, for instance.
That movie has surprisingly little nudity, actually.
And orgy involving mother-in-law. So here's the game I came up with.
All right.
I was hoping that you would play this game with me.
I'll play it.
All of Lynch's films seem to be of a piece. They are very definitely coming from the same mind.
Yes.
In fact, Lost Highway has a lot of things in common, as we stated, with Mulholland Drive. Mm-hmm. It also has a lot of things in common with Blue Velvet.
Mm-hmm.
There's things that are very similar. So, can we name the tropes and features,
mm-hmm,
that distinguish something as a David Lynch film? Something happens, you black out, you wake up and you're watching a movie. How can you instantly tell that it's a David Lynch film?
Oh, gosh.
I'll throw one out and then you throw one out. Please note, I have these written on a card. I'm expecting Patrick to pull them out of his ass. Figures emerging from the darkness.
Gosh. I mean, certainly that quality that we just sort of pinpointed in the tailgating scene, I think, is specific to David Lynch, the juxtaposition of this violence and sort of an undercurrent of comedy.
But almost an inverse of the way Sam Raimi uses comedy in Evil Dead 2, the comedy makes it more terrifying.
Exactly.
I'm thinking of the scene we just played the sound clip from, and I'm thinking of Frank Booth in Blue Velvet, where the scene where he terrorizes Isabella Rossellini, and he has this mysterious gas that he keeps sucking on from a face mask, and we never learn what the gas is, and that he's hitting her, and he's abusing her, and then he's saying things like, mommy, mm-hmm, mommy, and don't you look at me, don't you look at me. And somehow...
Almost verbatim, though, those were my wedding vows.
I pause now to absorb the dark, dark poetry that is our friend Patrick of late. Another thing I noticed. Lynch's bad guys love to drive. There's that American obsession with driving. That's in, I think, all of his films except Eraserhead, which sort of stands out. But think of The Journey in Wild at Heart. Think of the ride they take Kyle MacLachlan on in Blue Velvet. That obviously in Lost Highway, there's a lot of driving. What else distinguishes a Lynch film?
Gosh.
I'm putting Patrick on the spot.
Yeah. I mean, again, I keep saying like juxtaposition, but you know, he's constantly sort of, a lot of filmmakers now, unfortunately, are consumed with the idea of like the seedy underbelly. But David Lynch is really the guy who kind of perfects it, where he takes sort of these very specifically American archetypes, whether it's suburbia in Blue Velvet or sort of Elvis and Marilyn Monroe in Wild at Heart,
Hollywood in Mulholland Drive,
and sort of undercuts it with the dark, dark stuff that's happening behind the scenes.
Just like there is a dark, dark homeless person living behind that diner, and trust me, that's one of the scariest things I've ever seen.
Right.
And a couple months ago, or maybe it was a year ago, my son was watching Mulholland Drive for the first time in our family room, and I just had to sit there and look at his face when that, man, if you want to get scared.
Even when you know it's coming. And that's the thing. The reason that shot works is because it goes for so long that you convince yourself, I'm not going to see anything.
That's right.
This is a red herring. And then just when you've let your guard down is when you see it. And it's timed so well.
And it's on screen for so little time.
Yeah.
There's that, what did I see? And even in the theater, you were sort of reaching for your remote that's not there.
And that's one of those moments in Mulholland Drive where no matter how well you think you have a handle on sort of the narrative of that movie, that is never answered. Well, what's the guy behind the diner, you know?
No, there's always loose ends in Lynch films.
Yeah.
But again, the homeless person behind the diner in Mulholland Drive, I would put right up there with the head from the boat in Jaws in terms of all-time scary things. And we'll end the Lynch tropes thing, because Patrick's already sick of it, by suggesting that in every David Lynch film, until the actor passed away, we have Jack Nance, who I love. And the story goes that when Lynch was making his first film, he made it on a very low budget. He had a grant from the American Film Institute, and it took him 2 years to finish, because he would work on it and then stop and then raise some money and then do something else. And he had this. It took them 2 years to finish the film. And Jack Nance is the protagonist, and he has a very unique hairstyle, which the actor had to keep for 2 years because Lynch took that long to make the film. And apparently Lynch rewarded him by casting him in every single thing he ever did until Jack Nance passed away. Unfortunately, Jack Nance is no longer with us, but he shows up for a couple minutes in Lost Highway.
As does Richard Pryor, I think, in his last movie.
I wanted to point that out. It's a great cameo. It's really short.
Yeah.
He's maybe in 4 minutes of it. But after the Balthazar Getty character comes back to the automobile garage where he works, we find out that Richard Pryor is the owner, and Richard Pryor is very happy to see Balthazar Getty because he's been away for a while. And it's a fairly long exchange between the two of them, but then at the very end of it, Pryor's in a motorized wheelchair, and he turns and sort of yells happily, "Pete's back!" to no one in particular, and I have to think that was an ad lib. It's so wonderful and so you don't get, that's not a movie moment.
Right.
That's a life moment.
Right.
Hey, Pete's back. He just shouts it.
There's this weird thing where Pete has been gone, but we don't know where he was. And his parents keep referring to that night, and we don't want to talk about that night. And there's all these, it goes back to this idea that at any time, but what Bill Pullman did is sort of threatening to break into his fantasy, but he keeps finding ways to sort of wallet out. And watching it today, there are even shots that sort of reoccur throughout the movie we talked about Lucas and his love of symmetry. There's actually a lot of visual symmetry going on in Lost Highway. The first example I think of is that intense close-up on Patricia Arquette's lips where she's talking on the phone. The first time it's to the police, the second time it's to Pete. But again, it's this indication that, well, this is the same, we're looking at the same person. Real quick, I want to mention too, this shot that I love early on in the film where it's just about silence and I'm living with a stranger because she's having an affair and I'm just paranoid. Somebody's videotaping us. The house starts to feel very scary. And he's in bed with Patricia Arquette and she sort of sits up, but it's very dark in the room. And so she's just in silhouette. And again, for a second, it's this idea of there's a stranger in my bed with me. And that's an effective shot. And then it cuts back to Bill Pullman. And when it cuts back to Patricia Arquette, it's that same silhouette, only now Robert Blake's scary face is superimposed over it. And that's one of the scariest moments in the movie too.
I even noticed little things this afternoon, like at the beginning, we see Pullman going through his house and going to the front step and going to the intercom, and the editing is so discontinuous that we cut to a long shot of the house from the outside, and now he's in the window. But because we expected him to be somewhere else, for just a second, we think it's someone else.
Right.
You know the shot I'm talking about.
Yeah.
It's very disturbing.
Are we meant to think that Dick Laurent is the guy that Patricia Arquette, the Renee character, was sleeping with?
I'm not sure, because if that's the case, then who's the hipster at the party?
Andy.
With the very carefully trimmed mustache. Another thing, and again, the film is in two pieces and we're meant to question the reality of both. Clearly, Robert Loggia is Dick Laurent.
Yes.
And yet, during the Balthazar Getty part, they call him Mr. Eddie.
Right.
Is that an alias?
Why is Renee Alice? Right. You know? And the only reason I bring up that maybe it was – right, and because she's with Andy at the party in the reality, and so we think, well, Andy is the guy that he thinks she's sleeping with. But I think about Dick Laurent is dead at the beginning of the film, and maybe we're meant to assume that Bill Pullman has also killed – Dick Laurent. And that's what we're seeing at the end of the...
Because at the end of...
He goes and finds them having sex at a hotel and murders Robert Loggia. And so maybe we're meant to believe that he killed both of them.
Or, as in your interpretation, that Bill Pullman kills his wife and is put in prison. And then in prison has a lengthy fantasy where he's in denial about what actually happened. And during the prison fantasy, again, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seems that during that sequence, he also vicariously kills her lover.
Right.
Because, I mean, that's obviously what caused him to kill her. Because I tend to look at Lynch's films as being so abstract, I had never gotten an interpretation of Lost Highway to the point that you did. And as I mull it over in my head, I'm starting to like it more and more.
I think it's his most underrated movie. And I think even the fact that Mulholland Drive was very popular, and to a lot of people does Lost Highway only better, I think that allows people, I think, to discredit Lost Highway a little bit. Although I think it has been rediscovered somewhat in recent years.
And again, we're doing this podcast and a couple months will go by and I will start regarding them as the same movie again.
Yeah.
I think they're so much of a piece. And after you see Mulholland Drive, you will never hear the word silencio the same again.
I guess that's it, right? Everybody go see Lost Highway.
I believe someone had suggested that we do this film.
I don't think so, no. I think...
This was Patrick forcing his will upon me. And what you might not understand is we've been doing this podcast, but Patrick isn't here. He's at your house.